This podcast episode is sponsored by Silver Spun Goods. Silver Spun Goods is a woman-owned American sock brand that produces socks spun with pure silver. Their company was built on the beliefs that all of their products would be kind to your skin. The silver in their socks kills odor-causing bacteria, meaning no stink, is antimicrobial, meaning no germs, and conducts heat, making them toasty warm. They're also kind to the environment. Minimizing their environmental footprint and supporting U.S. production is incredibly important to the brand. So the cotton for their yarn is grown and spun in the U.S., the silver is produced in the U.S., and all of their products are crafted in the U.S. I didn't plan this, but I'm actually wearing a pair of these socks as I record this, and they're genuinely my absolute favorite. I always wear them when I know I'm going to have a long day or a particularly hard task to accomplish because they make me feel like I'm Wonder Woman and I can do anything. Wearing them is genuinely like a giant self-love hug to your feet, and they make me feel like walking on clouds. For a limited time, use code MATERIALCULTURE, that's one word, for 20% off your entire order at silverspungoods.com, which we'll also link in the show notes. You can also find them on Instagram and Facebook at Silver Spun Goods.
Welcome to the Material Culture Podcast, where we're exploring narratives of weaving, history, manufacturing, and the people who make it all possible. This is a place where we get to look closer at the common thread that connects us all, how we're all interwoven, not just in art, but in what it means to create as humans. I'm your host, Rachel T. Snack. Not to be confused with Rachel E. Snack, who runs Weaver House, the parent company of this podcast. I'm no expert weaver, but I am a question asker, a constant learner, and someone who believes that the world would be a better place if we took the time to listen to each other's stories. This month, I had the pleasure of speaking with Shaniqua Brooks, a Caribbean-American, Chicago-based weaver. We talked about what it means to really let a community influence the ways you create, and what a comfort it can be to make these tactile reminders of sisterhood and the support of our friends. We talk about her story of a family legacy of strong women, but also what it means to let go of the burden of always being strong, of finding moments of tenderness and indulgence, and how her art has helped her to process all of that. We're all more connected than we think. Join us as we find our common thread. I'm here with Shaniqua Brooks, who's an entrepreneur who received her Master's of Design in Fashion, Body, and Garment at School of the Art Institute of Chicago under the mentorship of Nick Cave and Liat Stemmond. Hi, Shaniqua. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Rachel. Thank you for having me.
So we love to talk about culture on this podcast and the traditions that kind of shape how we create art. So what do you bring to your art from your identity and experience as a Caribbean American woman, as a Black woman living in America? How has that shaped how you create?
For me, it started with the Black woman being the foundation and the base of everything that unravels and unfolds and what bleeds into other works. As always, the Black woman and what she stands for in my eyes and what she deals with, how she handles things around her, her family, her personal life, workspaces, etc. I think being raised around strong Black women from the Caribbean, from my mother to my aunts, my great aunts, grandmothers, etc., they have definitely paved a way of independence and do it all type of thing, which can also be detrimental in the long run when it comes to self. I think that what the culture of the Caribbean holds and how the woman is represented and how she pushes forth into the world of doing it all, especially being raised under a single parent mother, has been the root of why I even made in the first place and how I cope with that independence because the women in my life are very, very strong. So you can get overlooked very easily.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I went away in college for art school, it was very important for me to find my own voice and what that looked like and how I wanted to move forth in life. So weaving in hair started to be a part of that conversation to make me deal with the trauma and the struggles and the celebrate what took place within all of that.
How did your family come to be here? Like, where in the Caribbean are they from, and when did they come to America?
So I was born in St. Thomas, U.S. Virgin Islands. My mom and my dad met there. My dad's side of the family is from there, as well as St. Martin. And my mom's side is from the Eastern Caribbean Islands, St. Kitts and Nevis. So I was born in 92, and my mom went from St. Kitts to St. Thomas, and then St. Thomas to Miami. My dad stayed in St. Thomas, but he was well-traveled because he went to school in New York and, you know, other parts of the world. But yeah, that's how it has come to be.
So when you got to school, what was that like? Like, what did you feel like you were learning about yourself as an artist or as a young adult?
Being brought up in a public school system was very different for me. It was a lot of not conversing with my mom about what took place at school, because I know she'll be like mama bear and like go off. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of me working through certain instances because I went to predominantly Black school in elementary and middle school. You know, coming from the household, like my mom has never had that kind of conversation with me like most Black mothers would have with their Black sons or Black daughters, specifically Black sons, about the social climate we're dealing with. So, you know, at home, it was, I kept it separate. I didn't want to bring that toxic energy home. So my home was always a safe haven for me. Even though I went into the arts, I was in the magnet art program in middle school. And then from there, segued into really pursuing art as going to performing arts high school. So it was very different. The social climate was very different. I didn't really look at color anymore so much, even though I was the only Black student, not the only, but like three of us. But what I really focused on was the actual art.
Yeah.
You know, connecting dance, music, and art itself. So it was, that definitely informed me as far as a language to deal with life.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think art serves as that for so many people. It's that you can only draw from your own experiences, and art is how we make sense of our own experiences and how we had to deal with things. So yeah, how have you used art as that extension of yourself, as a space to process? And how does that feel to create in that space?
Well, for me, it started with drawing. I have a very traditional trajectory as far as becoming an artist professionally. I've done art all my life. I went to art schools. I studied really hard to get to where I'm at, but it started off with drawing. And I used to always draw with a pen. So when I would make mistakes, I had to deal with how to make it what I want it to be. Mm. I used to hate drawing with a pencil because I always have this tendency to be a perfectionist and continue to erase and start over and start over. So I disciplined myself and I challenged myself and started to use pen. And from there, the medium started to grow into like charcoal, to like watercolor and paint, acrylic specifically. I was not an oil person at all. And then it became a thing where I was so engulfed and fascinated with textiles, probably like my sophomore, junior year. Prior to that, I always loved textiles and fashion specifically. Yeah. But then it became this thing that I wanted to learn how to make it more so than like purchase it in a store or something. I was very impressed with the process making of making a cloth. And that's how I was introduced to weaving as a term and as what that looks like. And then it became a thing of Ghana, West Africa came into the picture because I would always look through magazines or even browse the internet and be so like, oh my God, pin this, pin that, sort of like my Pinterest board, and I would create it and I would print out the pictures and put it all on a board. And I would be like, how do you do this? Like, these designs are just so beautiful. And then when I started to read upon it, it was this thing that it had stories that were embedded into these fabrics, into these beautiful woven cloths. And it, the, when the women or the men would wear it, it was for a specific reason. And it wasn't like here in America where we put on something, it was like, I'm wearing this for comfortability, or I'm wearing this for, you know, to show off this or whatever. But no, for them, it was more catered towards ceremonial purposes or a celebratory event or even death. So that conversation started to open up for me. And then that's when I dug a bit deeper and I was like, yo, this is all going back to Ghana, West Africa. I need to go there. I need to figure out what that means to me, because it's always popping up simultaneously into my life.
So you did go there. When was that, and how was that for you?
So I did. I went in 2014, in the fall of 2014, and it was an incredible, incredible experience. And I have to shout out the Center for Craft. So I essentially got a fellowship and they awarded me a $15,000 grant where I proposed to learn traditional Ghanaian textiles in Ghana. And shout out to Sebastian Dai, who was my teacher. And you know, it was an incredible experience.
Ghana is known for their colorful kente cloth, a textile made of handwoven strips of silk and cotton. Shaniqua learned to weave on a horizontal loom and practice the techniques of mozizi, a plain weave pattern, zifople, a twill weave, and sogi, which is a net-like pattern, among others.
I was there for 3 months, and I was very much embedded and engulfed in the culture to the best that I could possibly be. I was in the village. I was in a small village called Amloga, which is southeast of Accra, which is the capital. And I had stayed with who I call today my grandmother. Her name is Hilaria. And at the time, she was dealing with a lot of things, the recent death of her husband. So while I was there, she was grieving, and they grieve for a period of time and they have to wear the color black. And she would wear that. And, you know, I just started to learn, and we both were grieving in different ways because I was having slight withdrawals from not being home in America as well. And it was a very beautiful thing to experience. You know, I woke up to the farmers on the right of me, and the ocean is on the left of me, and, you know, the fishermen doing their thing. I had fresh fish all the time, and I had fresh fruits and veggies every day. And I didn't even know what that felt like until I was there. And then I come back to America and I'm like, yo, what is this that I'm eating?
Yeah.
But no, it was a beautiful experience that has now become a pillar of my art practice.
What kinds of things did you learn there that have been built into your art practice, whether that's like textile traditions or like the way that they live?
I would say definitely outside of, because I tell people I went there to learn how to make cloth, to weave cloth. And I walked away much more than that. In fact, it came to the point where I totally was just like, oh no, I didn't come here for that. I learned about community. I learned what community actually meant, what it looked like being in the village. I learned about more of the culture of being a Ghanaian and what that looked like where I was specifically, because, you know, every place is different. Like when I went to Kita, it was different. When I went to these other villages, it was different. So I was catered, like me being an Anloga, I started to learn about that community and what that looked like for them at the time. I also built friendships. I learned how to communicate with them beyond the lens of, how do I put this? Because they spoke English, but that's not their first language. They also have their own local language, which the most universal local language is Ewe. And I started to learn that. And for the weavers out there, they know, we know weaving has their own, its own language in itself. You know, I would say a beautiful moment was when Sebastian, he would have to, I would record him doing it because he couldn't explain what he was doing to me. and English. And again, that goes back to weaving as its own language as well. Even though we do speak English, we have our own language with weaving. So it was even more difficult for him to explain it to me. I would record it and I would write down notes of exactly what he did. And then I would share it with him. And he's like, oh, this is what we call children. This is what we call mother. This is what we call this. And we built our own language. And it'll be moments where I'm drawing in the sand, and he'll draw something. And I'll be like, that's what that is. And then that's what we call that in America. And he's like, oh, this is what we call it in Ghana. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is beautiful. Like, we're legit creating our own language right now. And that is another thing I learned, is what does language look like to me? How does that evolve? And what language am I creating myself as an artist to then, you know, reveal out there into the world? So it was quite beautiful.
That's so cool how it kind of transcends being from different places, not speaking the same verbal language, but sharing is in common about art and textiles, and even just the human experience, I think is really cool. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty beautiful. What I love about Ghana is it has its moments where it's fast paced and it's busy, but then I feel like from my point of view, it's still slowed down. Like, it forces you to slow down. It's not a New York, you know? Yeah. It's not a Chicago where I'm based.
Yeah.
It's its own thing where they have little pockets of like, yeah, they're on a mission. But overall, I can breathe and still walk fast and not be pressured to get something done. Like, when I'm in New York, I'm like, oh my God, I'm in New York. I got to go here. Like, even to the grocery store, you're like walking with the swiftness. Like, you have a mental pace to like, you got to go do this. Like, it goes back to the way of living too is different. Yeah. Their priorities is different. I think they are a prime example, and similar to the Caribbean in the aspect of they can have little to nothing and be happy and still find a purpose to get up in the morning and do what they have to do to support themselves and their family. And that, to see that, and to celebrate that, was just mind blowing. Because here where I'm at, I only know one neighbor. I don't know people in my building. I don't communicate with them. Over there, they know everybody in the whole community, like the whole like village area. Everybody knows everybody. I had to pinch myself quite a bit there. Be like, this is real. This is not just a dream. Like, I would always dream about going to Africa growing
up. Yeah.
And for that to become a reality and a part of like now a familial experience for me, it's just like, whoa.
In her trip to Ghana, it wasn't just learning new things about the culture that had an impact on Shaniqua, but also allowing a different experience to reshape how she saw her life in the U.S. The way that culture was in Ghana informed everything, from the type of material they create and for what purpose, even down to who does the creating.
Traditionally in Ghana and just Africa, and I hope I'm saying this right, that men are traditionally weavers. Mm. Nowadays, women do weave. And me being Sebastian's first Black woman he's ever taught was mind-blowing. I was taught how to weave from a woman. I was taught how to do a lot of things from a woman. And for me to be taught something from a man was in itself a huge thing for me.
Yeah.
And for him to then show me around and take me to these ceremonial sacred spaces.
Yeah.
And I was very respectful in the way that I was like in the back. I didn't want to intrude, you know, I stayed in the back, but they noticed me and they invited me to be a part of their experience. It was very beautiful. But they look at it as a functionality and a way of living. You know, it's like a trade, more so than art.
Yeah.
Not saying there's not artists on the continent. Of course there are.
Right.
And I consider them all to be artists in their own right. I just feel from... this is a part of their way of living. They make cloth, they weave cloth as a purpose to trade and to make.
Well, because when you look at Ghanaian like fashion or African fashion in general, it's like this really beautiful fabric that is so like vibrant and beautiful before it's even made into a garment, you know? So it's like,
exactly. Definitely. I don't know how they wear white though, but hey, white people love to wear white.
And I feel like that ties into what you said earlier about the way that Ghanaian textiles are made and like that it's for a purpose. Like, I think that really ties into the idea of community that like, I'm not making this just to make it, I'm making it for my friend's wedding or like for like, you know, it's so, I think in one way it's functional in a way that a lot of art in the Western world isn't as functional, but also that I'm making this so that we can really go all out. Cause Ghanaian weddings are like multi-day events, right? Like there's all kinds of, there's different dresses and everybody's all decked out, right?
I experienced a christening. I was a part of that, which was so beautiful. I experienced 2 to 3 funerals. So over there, they open it up to everybody in the community to attend unless it's meant to be private. I was just in awe, like, at what took place ceremonially. Like, it was just, like, mind-blowing. Like, a book cannot capture that moment for me. In that experience, it was so visceral, it was so real. Like, I was like, where am I?
The fact that you were there, I feel like, as someone who is new, as someone who is only there for a little while, like that you went to 3 funerals is crazy, right? That it's that open.
It didn't feel like a funeral to me. Like, I felt like I was at a mashup of like a party mixed with, like, I don't know. It was so of its own kind.
It was incredible to hear from Shaniqua about the openness that allowed her not just to learn textile creation, but also deep practices of mourning and celebrating in community from the people she met in Ghana. Just like her experience overseas, the art that she's made since returning to the States tells us of the experiences and art that inform it.
So recently, I consider myself, a part of my art practice, to be a storyteller and to express myself visually and with my words. And that goes back to language, et cetera. And I feel like 2020, for most people or everybody for that matter, has woken us up in different ways or reminded us of things in different ways. And it was a lot going on, a lot of grieving, not necessarily of a person, but of the experience of it all. And for me, how I cope with it is through writing and making. That's it. Those are my outlets. And I did a lot of writing on myself about various things that has taken place for me. And just society and what am I doing? How am I moving forth with it? But when it came to the making process, it was very interesting because I was dealing with a lot of different emotions that I just had to let it just flow through me. It was one of those things where I couldn't stop it and I couldn't go around it. I literally had to just either sit there and my hands was just moving. I didn't have anything set in place. I was just putting it all out there, you know? And I feel with my new collection that I'm working on, this new body of work titled She Feels, it had to start off with the core of what am I going through? And let me just preface, like, all my work is a woman. It's always a female. I always refer to my work as a she.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And that just comes from the fact of I'm a woman and I love women. Not necessarily sexually, but I admire the Black woman and I admire what women do. And that's just what that is. So every work that I make is an extension of that. So it's only right to refer to her as a her. So, you know, how I'm making the work right now is evolving to a place that is exciting. I have room for play. I'm playing around with different things. I'm exploring new patterns that I'm learning. But then I'm also just letting it be.
I mean, even in the title, She Feels, it's seeing what we sometimes think of like as an emotional state or like a thought process as an action in itself. Like it is an action just to feel, it is an action just to grieve, and that you're processing that through your work. And I was really drawn to the She Feels when I saw it in your gallery, because it just stands out that you're using synthetic hair in it and braids in it in a way that you don't often see in weaving. And I think that feels so personal and specific, like you said, to the Black woman experience, right? Like there's no way that anyone else could make that. Tell me more about that.
So the Black, okay, first of all, hair is very much a part of my life and the way I do things. And the women in my life, I've seen that, even the men. And I think I consider my hair to be my crown. And it's just such a art in itself, like what takes place on my head. So the Black hair salon plays a huge role as well as in my upbringing. My aunt had her own salon. And even prior to that, my mom made sure our hair was done all the time, me and my sister. It was either braids, like I went back into like the photo album and I saw my hair like braided up all kinds of ways. And I was like, no wonder I love braids. But then it became a thing as I was getting older, when my aunt had her own hair salon, what would happen is I would go and I would help her around the salon. And that would sort of be like my pay to do my hair. And then when I got older and I could get to decide and choose, that's when I really went all out and I would like dye my hair. I would get all kinds of different color weaves in my hair, and it'll be either sewn in, glued in, you name it. It was just infinite. And then it like turned into more personable in the sense that my sister would do my hair. And then it became what took place in those moments. But in general, the Black hair salon is more than just doing one's hair. It's really another safe space, sort of like this very sacred space where you talk about life, you know, you meditate, it's like a breath of fresh air. As you're getting what you want done to your hair and you're pampered, you're letting go of other issues that has happened throughout the week or just prior to you arriving. And you let it go and you walk out and you're a new woman again. You know, it's like you revitalize. So that process and what took place and what I've experienced at a very young age, even all till now, is definitely a part of that conversation in my work.
How did you choose to use the synthetic hair and use the braids in specifically processing 2020? Like, how do those two things correlate?
Synthetic hair started off in my work as just the material use of the worst quality of hair and making it something beautiful. Braiding has always been a part of my experience. I never was taught how to braid, by the way. I just did it myself. I learned. My sister, everybody around me knew how to do this thing. And one day I just decided to try it. And the more that I did it, the better it looked. And it became this thing that literally physically ties something together and it holds something, right? But then it also becomes this signifier of the bond that started to create and form sisterhood for me. And it became what took place when my hair is braided is a tribe, a group of women that I love and care about came together to do this thing. And, you know, whether they're getting their hair done or not. And I thought that in itself was represented in the process of me physically braiding this hair. And that was just like immediately embedded into what I do. So for me, it represented every moment in time that I was in these spaces. And then it made me think about what took place. What was that moment? And what did I walk away with? You know, so that's kind of how I fell in love with it. You know, it started off with, is this possible? And then once I found out this was possible to weave, it just kind of unraveled and it went in its own direction.
And how meaningful is that in a year where you couldn't have your sisterhood physically around you? Now you're like physically doing something that kind of signifies that friendship, that community, in a time where you really need that comfort.
Exactly. And for me, I had to create it. That's what artists do. We create these spaces where it doesn't necessarily exist or where we don't have access. I think 2020 has taught me to give myself grace and ease in spite of it all. And how me living by myself here in Chicago and me coping with the lack of human contact, like we all are juggling and balancing in our lives, like how can I bring it into this small space that I live in? Mm-hmm. You know, I have pictures up of my family around me. I have friends' artwork up around me. And that is a reminder all the time, like you're not alone. But then where it comes to me making, I don't bake every single day physically. I make in different ways every day. And I think that helps. That helps create that space and then sit behind my loom and continue the conversation.
So you've talked about like creating your own textile language. You've talked about, art as continuing this conversation. How have you created your own language in your own practice?
That is a fantastic question, Rachel. I'm in the midst of figuring out what that is for myself. But what I can say is when I make in the process, especially during these times of me having my studio at home, it's starting to merge. My way of living and making is starting to overlap. And that is a very interesting place to be in for me right now as I continue to grow as an artist. You know, traveling and other things contribute to that. But I feel for me right now, as we are in isolation, essentially, that my way of living and what I am making is slowly coming closer and closer together. I wouldn't say it's becoming one. They're still separate, but it's very close. Like they're side by side now.
Well, it becomes a lot more messy, right? When you don't have the lineation between like, okay, what is work? What is life? What is, I mean, art in general is so personal. So to be an artist as a profession, like feels like it's walking that line a lot. Like that this is something that I'm doing to generate an income, but it's also such a part of me. But then I feel like the line is even more blurred when you don't have a studio space, when you don't have like as rigid hours, and just when you might need your art to process what's going on personally, and it's not necessarily creating to make what people need, but more like what you need.
Exactly. And you know what, I've always come from that. I'm blessed. I always come from a point of where I need, even when I do commissions for people, I definitely, you know, have a conversation preliminary with them about like who they are, what they do. And then we start to talk about the work, but I'm always a part of that. I have to stay true to that. Like I tell people all the time, if you're commissioning me to do a work for you, you have to love what I do. I'm not one of those artists where you're like giving me a long list of things that you want. No, it doesn't work that way over here. I ask specific questions. You are more than happy to answer those questions. And that's it. You don't give me oh, you know, it's just too much. Yeah. Then I start to lose myself. And if I can't be a part of that, then it's not worth it to me.
Like, your art is your art still, even when it's for someone else.
Exactly. And thankfully, everybody, all the collectors that I have this far, love what I do. They give me the free range to do what I do. The only, like, quote unquote limitation is probably like a color palette or something, which is totally fine. But other than that, they're like, I love what you do and I trust the process. So do you.
The 2020 pandemic was an awakening for many of us, Shaniqua being no exception. We talked about the spiritual aspects of spending so long in isolation and what it meant for her to really take inventory of what parts of herself and her story were beautiful, but also what family patterns were things that she wanted to break free of. Shaniqua describes this as generational curses, things that are passed down in our families that hold us captive. For Shaniqua, this year meant examining a generational curse of sacrifice, something that can be a beautiful way to give your all to the people who love you, but that also might mean bleeding yourself dry. In 2020, Shaniqua pressed more into what it would mean to meet her own needs through what she calls a love language.
And I feel that me taking the time for myself, whatever that looks like, whether that's me indulging in a chocolate cake, me watching Netflix, me, you know, those moments as well add to that spiritual routine of mine. And I feel like that when I give myself that permission to indulge in those things, it allows a part of me to be at peace, to keep sane, to know that everything is going to be okay. And it just brings a bit of clarity as well to the whole situation at hand, or just the process. I feel like us as human beings, we fiend for a lot of various things that keeps us going, that we kind of deprive ourselves of as discipline. Mm. But I don't look at things like that anymore. Mm. There were a lot of things I had to unlearn and figure out what I like and love to do. And it's okay to reward myself, however, as often as I find fit to do those things. You know, some people shopping and indulging and spending their money on whatever might be frivolous to you, but for them, it's not. I feel like we are taught to overwork and burn ourselves out as a way of equating to, I deserve that. I feel for myself, and as I'm just continuing to grow as a woman, there are things that I have to put in place for myself to just move forth, put that one foot in front of the other, get up in the morning and say, today is going to be a good day, and make sure that it is, or make an effort, you know, because it's so easy to just be like, oh, you know.
Yeah.
And that's okay too in itself, but to really wake up and say, today's going to be a good day, and this is what I'm doing to make sure that this is a good day. And, you know, it's continuing to inform me, but when I refer to generational curses, what I mean by that is how I have seen my family on both sides generationally interact with one another and what has come out of it. There are certain things I want to change in my life when I have my own family. But before I have my own family, I want to start embedding that and doing that with myself as an individual. So when I am passing down these teachings or examples for my child, or even in relationship with my partner, it's something that can be more enforced. And that's why I refer to as generational curses. There are things that I've already accomplished in my life that my family has not. And there's still some things that I'm working on.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting too. Like, you talked about this in the very beginning about like the kind of legacy of women in your family and them being really strong and them being really like they defined the culture of your family, right? And I think that's the case for a lot of Black women, like, because we ask a lot of Black women, and like, especially, I don't know, with single moms are just like, I don't know, there's so much pressure. So Black women hold up our society in a lot of ways. Is that part of what you've been trying to unlearn and undo, that you have to do that?
There was a period in my upbringing where that's all Black women can do. And I'm unlearning that I am not responsible for that. And I'm learning that I shouldn't carry the burdens of other people. Like, that's how I was brought up. Like, you got to leave yourself undone for others. Mm-hmm. And I'm unlearning that.
It was an absolute joy to talk to Shaniqua, to hear about the influence of women and sisterhood that manifests itself in a tactile way through her work. If you get the chance to look through her gallery, you can see the vibrant colors and patterns that are so central to Kente cloth weaving in Ghana, as well as the braids that define so much of her self-expression as a Black woman in the United States. I think the theme I kept dwelling on after talking to Shaniqua was community, the ways in which her community in Ghana quickly became a second family to her, the ways in which that cloth that is carefully woven in Ghana is used for something as beautiful as a wedding or a christening, or the ways that it signifies something as meaningful as saying goodbye to a loved one at a funeral. In the same way, Shaniqua has written a love letter to the sisterhood that surrounds her here through the She Feels collection of weavings. We are all connected in so many ways. What better way to commemorate the community that builds us, that supports us, and that gives us life, than through something that we can touch and hold close? If you want to see more of her work, Shaniqua's website will be listed in the show notes, as well as her Instagram. A huge thank you goes out to Shaniqua for being our guest this month, as well as Silver Spun Goods for being an episode sponsor. Thanks also to Philadelphia-based musician Michael Myers for the use of his song Weave off the album There Is Only Light. We are currently publishing episodes of Material Culture Monthly, so look out for our next episode in March. And if you have comments or questions in the meantime, please email us at our address linked in the show notes. Thanks so much for joining us. And until next time, let's keep learning about what it means to create with each other in mind. Mm-hmm.